The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. Now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but if God exists, where the heck is he? Why doesn't he involve himself more in human affairs, especially when there's so much suffering in the world and evil? And we've seen both this week. We saw some horrible murders in Britain, and then, of course, we've got tornadoes, and not the fun kind of tornadoes that whisk Dorothy off to Oz, tornadoes that are devastating. Where is God? Why doesn't he come as a knight in shining armor and help his people? Well, he does, my friend, he does more often than you would think. Not usually in our timing. If you look at the Bible, you'll notice that people usually waited a long time when they were waiting for God to rescue him. And then, of course, naturally, oftentimes in this world, it doesn't look like the rescue happened at all, unless we believe in the afterlife. Now, as it happens, the Bible's key on the afterlife. And some of you think, oh, Siegel, that old cop-out. Well, look, I think it is unimaginable for anybody to sit and just say to themselves, someday I'm going to die and I'm never going to have another conscious thought for all of eternity. I think there's an eternity in your heart that cries out to you and bears witness that that is not true. If you keep in mind that heaven is not to be supposed to be some celestial graveyard where people go when they die, but rather heaven is a continuation of life as God had intended life. God had never intended for human beings to die at all. It was because our ancestors turned away from God that he unplugged himself from people and unplugged himself from this world. But he still cares about this world. Our free will has an awful lot to do with the mess that we're in. Anyway, God does rescue us. But one thing is certain, human beings love the idea of rescue. They love the idea of heroes, and often they love it in the realm of the supernatural. Now, last week we started a discussion, and I mentioned that many of my atheist friends who claim that they don't believe in the supernatural still gravitate towards science fiction and fantasy to a lesser degree. And we use that as a kind of a springboard to talk about some recent movies that have come out. Film critic Mark Boobian was here when the show was over. Mark said, boy, that was fun, but I didn't even get through half of what I'd intended. I said, well, why don't you just come back next week? So this is kind of a part two from last week. Mark, welcome back to our program.
Thanks, Bob. It's great to be here again. And, you know, you mentioned tornadoes. The one movie I didn't see was the Oz movie. But you had a chance to, and I think that would be a good one to talk about.
Let me start. Yeah, I need to preface this by saying that I love the motion picture of The Wizard of Oz, and I have read, a lot of people don't realize that they were based on some books written by Frank Baum, and there are about 30-some Oz books that have been written.
Oh, wow.
The first 15 or so, something like 15, by Baum himself, and then the series even continued after he passed away. One thing that's fascinating, if you go down to the Hotel Del and look through their museum, or it used to be up in their museum, there are pictures of Frank Oz. He used to live at the Hotel Del.
Oh.
And there are pictures of him sitting on the lawn telling stories to kids. It's fascinating. And there's a room at the Hotel Del called the Crown Room, where the chandeliers look like crowns. Frank Baum himself designed those chandeliers in that room. So he was a fascinating person. He was actually writing a satire of American politics. Now, the books are very different from the movies. In the book, Dorothy really goes to Oz. Of course, in the movie, it's all a dream. But a couple of the brilliant lines from the books survived. Like I said, he was trying to write a satire on American politics. It was one of those times when the fairy tale was for adults as well as kids. One of the lines from the book that makes it in, of course, is when the Scarecrow is asked, how can you talk if you don't have a brain? He says, I don't know, but some people without brains do an awful lot of talking. And then one that I really liked is toward the end when we meet the man behind the curtain. And Dorothy says, "You are a bad man." He says, "No, my dear, I'm a very good man. I'm just a very bad wizard." Isn't that the way we look at a lot of our politicians? We expect them to be wizards or gods, and they're just human beings.
Right.
And we have to allow for that. And then another line that I love, now this one was in the movie, but not the book, but I loved it because, of course, this movie came out in the 1930s. It was The Wizard of Oz was up against Gone with the Wind for Best Picture of the Year. In fact, Gone with the Wind won the award. But this was during the time of the Great Depression. And he mentions to Dorothy in the movie, he says, "Well, I'm a Kansas man myself. I was carried away in a balloon by the wind, and I arrived in this land where everybody immediately called me a wizard." And then he said, "Times being what they were, I took the job," which if you were watching that movie in the 1930s, the humor of that line would just jump out at you. Okay, now this movie called Oz the Powerful is about him. It's about the story of his balloon carrying him over. Now, one of the things that I liked about the movie that I have to say right away is because I love the original Wizard of Oz novels and the Judy Garland musical version of the Wizard of Oz, because I love them so much, I have disliked every other movie version of Oz that they've come out with since then.
Oh, come on. And there's the Wiz, Bob.
Yeah, I did not care for the Wiz. There's a lot of stuff I did not care for. Now, I admit that I'm biased. I saw The Wizard of Oz at first when I was about to turn 6, but was still 5 years old. It was Christmas time. We were visiting my aunt and uncle and grandparents in Minnesota, visiting them from Florida, and on our way out to actually move to California. I had never seen color TV before. Of course, this is in the 1950s. This is the year 1959. TV hadn't really even been out that long. But my Uncle Frank, and my Uncle Frank is still alive, by the way, always has and still is the guy. He's the first to get every new gadget. I'm sure he has the latest in iPhones, and you know, I'm sure he has a screen even bigger than yours, Mark, at home for TV, if that's possible. Uncle Frank was always ahead of everybody else. So needless to say, Uncle Frank had a color TV. Now, I had never seen color TV before. I had only seen it in black and white because that's what we had at home. And my first experience with color TV was The Wizard of Oz. Oh,
that's perfect too. Yeah.
And it was such a clever gimmick in the movie where they started it. Actually, it wasn't in black and white. It was in sepia tone, but for all intents and purposes, black and white. And when Dorothy first steps out of that house into the land of Oz, what a beautiful effect. And for me to see that as a five-year-old kid, and it's my first experience with color TV, and it's such a wonderful movie, needless to say, that just became a classic. Watching The Wizard of Oz every year was almost like a holiday. It was almost like Christmas time. I think we've lost something in the fact that we can go and buy a copy of it. And of course, I own a copy of it. I'll never forget an article I read once where this woman picked up a copy of The Wizard of Oz for her daughter and then realized what a family treat they had watching it once a year. And she decided to put it back. And her daughter said, "But Mommy, it's our favorite movie." She said, "I know. That's why we're putting it back." She wanted it to remain special. So I've always loved it. Now, I read good reviews about Oz the Powerful. And so I thought, you know, I'm probably going to like it more than I think I would. I wasn't prepared to love it. I mean, Mark, nobody's more critical than you and I. Well, maybe Siskel and Roper. I don't know. But we're about as critical as they come. And I could not find one single flaw in this movie. Now, that doesn't mean it's my favorite movie, because something personal happens to make a movie your favorite. It is my second, the original Wizard of Oz, I mean, is my second favorite movie. The Sound of Music is my absolute favorite movie of all time. But even The Sound of Music has one line, I won't get into it because that's not why we're here today. There's one line in The Sound of Music that I just think is out of place, not funny, doesn't belong there. I could not find one bad line. This was the kind of movie where just watching the credits, when it began, the credits were so creative, I knew immediately. I said, whoever was clever enough to put these credits in this fashion is going to have a phenomenal movie. Now, what I liked about it, too, is it's a prequel to The Wizard of Oz. It paid homage to the other movie without trying to reproduce it. It's the backstory. It's spoiler alert if you haven't seen it, but it's been out a long time. You should have seen it by now. It's about how the Wicked Witch becomes wicked. Now, there was a Broadway musical called Wicked, and that story in some degrees was similar. I did not like Wicked. I, or more correctly put, I thought Wicked was very entertaining, but it was a satire. It was almost like watching Mel Brooks meets Oz. It was humorous. It was entertaining. It had interesting music. It had a horrible message, though. The wicked had, its message was, who's to say what's wicked?
Who's to say
what's right and wrong? Here they're taking this American, and we don't have a lot of distinctive American fairy tales. Most of our legends come from Norse mythology or Greek mythology, English mythology, King Arthur. Of course, Lord of the Rings was written by Tolkien, who wanted the British to have another set of mythology.
But those are all based on Norse style mythology,
somewhat. But here we had a very unique fairy tale that was just had an American flavor to it. But it was the good old fashioned. There's good. There's good evil. You know, as a Christian, I don't believe we should have any witches. I believe all witches are really empowered by Satan, even the ones who call themselves good. But I'll put that aside for a story. There were good witches. There were bad witches. There were good. There was evil. Then Wicked comes out and turns that on its head. I was afraid this movie was going to do the same thing, but they didn't. Good was still good. Evil was still evil. Now, what I loved about the movie, Mark, and I know you'll appreciate this, is they started it out in black and white.
Oh, they did. Credit, that's nice.
To pay homage to the other movie.
Right.
But not only that, Mark, but as you know, nobody knows this better than you, the ratio and the size of the screen was different in the 1930s. So
right,
you're watching this in one of these big AMC theaters with the great big wide, practically Cimarron angle screens, and yet you're watching the whole beginning of the movie, which is about the same length, 20 minutes or so that the Wizard of Oz was, and you're watching it not only in black and white, but you're watching it on the smaller screen.
Right, like a TV screen.
And then he drifts off in his balloon, and of course, when he lands in Oz, not only does it turn color, but the screen widens, and it's spectacular color. Of course, we can do things now with special effects that they couldn't do then. It was charming, it was witty, it was humorous. It's so seldom for me to just absolutely love a movie. And then I took my girlfriend Dana to see it, and she's never been a big Wizard of Oz fan. She's probably the only person in the world that doesn't like the Wizard of Oz. You and me and our friend Jim are probably the only three people in the world that don't like Forrest Gump. So Dana, even Nick's got his jaw dropped open. You don't like Forrest Gump? What's wrong with you? Okay, but Dana, I mean, she thought the witch was kind of creepy growing up. And I'd say the witch is supposed to be creepy. But anyway, I absolutely love this movie. Please, everybody, go and see this. If you love the Wizard of Oz, this will be one time where this new incarnation, it will not disappoint you.
Well, I'm glad to hear it, because the movie looks actually good. I saw some stuff prior to it being released, some of the, with the actors talking about it. And usually the actors talk about the characters and they say how wonderful the movie is. And there wasn't really any of that.
The actors are always going to say that.
Yeah, they have to, you know. But it
wasn't
really
like
that.
We were like a family when we worked. We weren't just a crew. We were a family on the set. I'm like, oh, give me a break.
Yeah, but it was Mila Kunis, who's one of the witches in the movie. She was just talking about the character and how much she enjoyed it and some of her, the way she approached the character. And I found it really interesting and kind of a revelation about the way she approaches acting more than it was about the movie. And I thought that that was nice, that she wasn't feeling like she had to sell the movie, that maybe the movie was actually going to be good enough to sell itself. And it does sound like that's what happened. And
unfortunately, I probably overstated it. Before I went to see Forrest Gump, people were saying it's the best movie I've ever seen. So naturally, nothing can live up to that. I think I would have hated it even if people hadn't told me that. On the other hand, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, which I liked and thought was a very good movie, people were telling me that was the best movie they'd ever seen, too. So it didn't live up. I'm not saying Oz the Powerful is the best movie I've ever seen, but I'm saying it's thoroughly entertaining. And I could not find, objectively, could not find one idle line, one flaw. When they wanted to be funny, they were funny. It wasn't that horrible feeling where you just sense them straining to be funny and it's not working. It just, it worked. That's the best. It worked from start to finish. What a way to pay homage to a classic without trying to reproduce the classic.
Right,
beautiful job.
Great. Well, I think Sam Raimi also, you could probably give him some credit for that. He's the director. He did the Spider-Man movies. He also did Evil Dead, which was this horror movie, the first movie ever did this just terribly dark and scary horror movie that the first time they showed it, the guy who they paid to show it in his theater came running out angry at them because you said this was a horror movie and everybody's laughing at it. You sold me this great comedy. What's going on here? So the poor
was
Sam
it horror,
Raimi at the
horror
time.
Movie in the tradition of mystery science theater?
Was no, it, that well, kind yeah, of yeah, movie? Right, exactly. No, it was a horror movie that they would put on mystery science theater. It was so bad that it was actually funny.
So he didn't mean it to be funny.
No,
but it,
but
came
it
out
just
though.
Turned out that way. And but I can still see it because he doesn't approach things totally seriously every time. There's maybe just one movie of his, maybe two that are serious, but. Almost every movie you see, there's some kind of wacky thing going on. So,
but now I think Alfred Hitchcock pulled that off. His movies were horror movies. Well,
they had a little bit of comedy.
Or at least a murder mystery, maybe not exactly horror. But there was there was always a quirky edge to it where you at times you found it funny, and yet it was still a very serious story.
Yeah, I think he
managed to know how to play that edge.
Right, and Sam Raimi doesn't know how to play that edge, actually. But you know what? I like him anyway, and he's funny.
Well,
it's like Savage.
I can testify he did a good job in Oz the Powerful.
Yeah, so I'm glad they chose him for this. He was the most recent thing he had done is Spider-Man, which the Spider-Man has some of these scenes where especially when they're the special effects scenes of Spider-Man fighting, where they look completely fake and kind of off kilter. If you're expecting reality
Spider-Man
in these scenes.
Spider-Man 3.
I thought one and two were great. I did not care for three. Now, but it is
either.
Spider-Man's buddy who kind of turns evil, who is the main
character. Right, James
character.
Franco is the
He's the main character.
Character
in Oz the Powerful.
Right, and he's a super good actor. That's the other thing I think to the movie's advantage. They had all really good actors playing the primary characters.
He did a superb job.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting to me about this movie, too, is that Disney, when Avatar was out, Disney did a release their first major 3D movie, Alice in Wonderland. It wasn't their first 3D movie, but it was the big one. And it was the same time it overran with Avatar. And it made them tons of money. It pushed them over $1 billion. Unfortunately for them, they've tried to duplicate that success every year since then, since 2010, and it's been terrible for them. They had Mars Needs Moms, which is this awful, awful-looking movie with the most terrible animation you've ever seen. I despised the company that did it. It was Robert Zemeckis' company called Image Movers.
Oh, that's too bad. He's normally produces pretty good stuff, Zemeckis.
Not in the animation world. So I always hated his style.
Oh, I'm remembering him from Back to the Future.
Yeah.
So that actually was not
that's
animation.
That's good, yeah. So, not everybody's a hit every time.
Think, McFly, think. Not everybody can do animation.
Exactly. So he couldn't. And fortunately, the only good thing you can say about Mars Needs Moms is that it killed that animation studio. Disney shut them down. Afterwards, then they unfortunately Disney followed it up, which is with what is considered to be one of the biggest flops in history, John Carter. That was last year, and that had a budget of $250 million minus probably all the advertising and everything, and it made $73 million, which isn't terrible, but when you're looking at a $250 million deficit, you're in trouble. So
now, I should say, I did not see Oz in 3D because I didn't want to pay extra for the 3D. And just watching it as a regular movie, it was still beautiful.
Yeah.
The 3D might make it better, might make it worse. I've seen some 3D movies where the 3D to me was a distraction and others where I really liked it. So I can't vouch yay or nay for the 3D. I can say even if you just watch it as a regular flat screen movie, it's beautiful.
Right, that's great. And, the 3D does tend to be an enhancement for most movies that you see when it's done right.
If it's done right. I don't know if they did that right. I know that as far as a regular cinematography goes, they did that right.
Yeah, and I've seen the advertisements, and it is very, very rich in imagery, and it's
color,
very beautiful.
The color is just spectacular, which it has to be if it's Oz.
Right,
you got to have good color if it's Oz.
Yeah, we have the Blu-ray of Wizard of Oz, and when it switches from black and white to color, you
that
have that
awesome.
Same...
Yeah.
That striking difference,
beautiful.
And it really comes across well. So that's a movie that fortunately they've done a very good job at preserving and redoing so that it looks good in the new format.
Oh, there's one more thing that I liked. They also made fun of the Wizard of Oz a little bit, but in a respectful way. There's a scene where the Munchkins are about to break into a song, and Oz just kind of goes, never mind.
Right.
And you would love this, Mark, because I know how you feel about music. They start breaking into the song. They get to like one verse, and then he stops and goes, never mind.
Yeah,
you can stop.
Right.
I thought that was hilarious.
That's okay. Yeah, that is funny. I like that. Well, I would pay money just for that one scene.
I think if you just saw that one scene, it would be worth it for you.
Yeah. I really did want to see Oz, and unfortunately, I didn't have the time to get out. But
well,
you know,
now you'll see it on Blu-ray and your big screen, and you don't even have to have somebody kicking your seat from behind. Win, win, win.
Yeah. Well, for me, I like the theatrical experience a lot of times because being in a crowd, you have that.
There's a communal experience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But you know what? Oz, to me, wasn't one of those movies where I felt like that was important. Star Trek, that's a movie I go see it with a bunch of people. You can scream and yell and holler, cheer for the good guys.
Well, since we grew up watching Oz on TV, by definition, it wouldn't have that communal thing.
Right,
we think, think of it more as a TV movie.
Yeah, because I never experienced Oz in the theater. It was really a TV movie for me, too. So that is a good point. I didn't even think of that. But since we're bringing up Star Trek, why don't we go ahead and talk about that a little bit?
Leapfrogging back,
yeah.
We did get into Star Trek last week. Why don't you go ahead and review a little bit of where we were with that?
Well, let's see. We were really just talking about what we liked and disliked. I was talking about what I disliked about.
We
Captain
were afraid
Kirk
to give away
primarily.
The plot because the movie had just come out a couple nights before. I think we're thinking this week.
We're going to let
it go. We know you
maybe.
Star Trek geeks. We know you don't wait a whole week to see a Star Trek movie. Or if you did, you've at least gone into the chat room. So if you still haven't seen it, spoiler alert, we're going to spill the beans. I don't think we did a great job covering it up last week anyway, but we did try. We tiptoed around it a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. But I think we did. Whatever. We'll see what happens. You know, we can play it by ear. But, you know, what I like about Star Trek, one of the things we talk about is how Star Trek has these social and political and sometimes spiritual even statements that it makes. And that's one of the great things about Star Trek is that it's an enjoyable series or of movies or TV shows to watch where you can engage in the stories and the fantasy and everything, but still come out with something afterwards. And to me, that's what I really look for in art. And, you know, one of the things that I've been saying for years is that even these big blockbusters now that people consider to be just popcorn throwaway movies really do often have something to say. And Star Trek, once again, does. And I think it asks a lot of questions, even beyond maybe what they intended. One of the things that I think I ended the show on last week was talking about the brutality that we see in the film. Now, that was a question that was raised to me after I watched it. It wasn't necessarily something
intentional. It wasn't hitting you at the time, but our friend Richard, who went to the movie with you, he brought that up.
Exactly. And it was, you know, that's not one of the things the filmmakers are going to intentionally want you to question, but I think it is a very good question to ask when you see a movie like this. Is it being too brutal? Is it showing too much? Is the violence level pushed up beyond a certain point where it's quote unquote acceptable, or it's affecting you in such a negative way that it's really detracting from the film? Now, there are movies that absolutely need violence because the story is a violent story or the story is upsetting or depressing. The Watchmen, a great example of a movie that has really graphic violence and is a very dark story, but that's the way the story is. So you don't want to shrouded in any veil of any sort. You want to, it's really in your face, and that's how that movie works. I'm not so sure that that's important for a movie like Star Trek, and that's a good question to ask. Some other things that I liked about the movie is the movie starts off kind of right away with this act of terrorism. And so right up front, now terrorism, since 9/11, that's basically the big threat and one of the biggest things on our minds as a people in terms of what we're doing internationally and politically even. Terrorism is it. That's the enemy of our time. And so to see it, you know, to see a major act of terrorism at the beginning of this film really pulls you right in. And so you're going to be confronted with what are we going to do to deal with this terrorism and what are the questions we should ask about it while we're watching the film, or what do the filmmakers want to convey to us?
Okay, well, we will talk about some of the questions we would ask about it. I'm here with film critic Mark Boubian, reviewing some recent movies. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
Bob now at 888-344-1170. That's toll free, 888-344-1170. Bob may have strong opinions, but he also likes to hear what you have to say.
Sound.
Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539, W&S Electric.
Do your kids ask you questions about God and the Bible that you can't answer? Sign yourself or your child up for a class with lots of solid answers at educateforlife.org before someone else gives them the wrong answers. Are you tired of not knowing what to say when your friends and family ask you questions about God and the Bible? Get equipped by signing up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone asks you, "How do you know the Bible's true?" do you say something like, "I just know it is"? If you're tired of giving lame answers, sign up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone says that God isn't real, wouldn't it be fun to prove that He is? Quickly, like a verbal ninja? By using science and logic. Sign up for a class at educateforlife.org with Christian apologetics teacher Kevin Conover, and you'll learn how to do that. educateforlife.org. If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's weekly column for Washington Times Communities. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net, S-I-E-G-E-L, bobsiegel.net. Here, you can download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. We now return to The Bob Siegel Show.
This is Bob Siegel and Mark Booby, and we're reviewing some, I guess you could call them summer movies, but yeah. As you mentioned last week, they're like pre-summer movies, movies that were shoved into spring, and in the case of Oz, shoved really kind of into
earlier,
winter.
Yeah. Yeah, the movie year is growing every year, which is great, because that means we get more movies. So, talking about Star Trek, the thing that, in terms of the terrorism and stuff, the Star Trek, what I like about Star Trek is it's a very subtle movie in terms of the questions you had. Not very subtle, but subtle enough that you're enjoying the story, but you have a lot of things that are modern, politically modern, and some of the stuff we're dealing with in terms of terrorism kind of woven into the story. And, you know, I'm thinking about them while I'm watching the story, but they're not so in your face that I feel like I'm being banged over the head with them. I mean, here are some of the terms they even use. They talk about, obviously, they're talking about terrorism because of that's how the movie starts. But then there's this mention of WMDs, weapons of mass destruction. They're going to commit some kind of surgical strike, something that we are big on as Americans because we don't want to kill people needlessly. So we like our surgical strikes. There's this notion of a possible invasion of the enemy territory to get one person. We may have to actually start this war and invade this other planet to get the one guy. Now, they're trying to avoid that in the movie, but that's one of the conflicts of the film a little bit. And there's even the idea that, do we want to go to war? You know, there are some people that actually do want war, and it's even their goal. And that, I think, is a question that was certainly raised, and a criticism of the Bush administration was thrown out all the time, almost to the point that it was ad nauseum.
Well, and when,
nausea
when,
being
when,
the keyword.
When somebody wants to go to war, usually the accusation is you want to go to war because you're a warmonger and you love war.
Right.
We don't always cut slack and say, maybe we all want to see evil stop, but we have different viewpoints as to how to go about it. You think we have to go to war. We're thinking there might be another way. The war might not be necessary. But we don't always give enough credit to the other side that they have perhaps good intentions.
Right.
We usually want to demonize the other side and say, oh, if you want to go to war, then that just means you're a warmonger.
Right.
Period. End of discussion.
Well, in this movie, I think we get the warmonger.
That's because the movie was probably written by somebody who believes that people that like war are warmongers.
Plus,
he probably put that into the script.
Right. And typically, you have good and evil in films, and the line tends to be a lot less gray. So there's a particular character who is quite villainous that you don't necessarily think
he's not that sympathetic, but he's a little sympathetic.
Right. Now, what's interesting, though, is the primary villain, they really do a good job of walking the line of whether or not you should sympathize with him, whether you're on his side or not. And that, I think, is one of the great strengths of this movie.
All right, I'm tired of walking on edges. It's Khan.
Okay,
Khan. We said we weren't going to cater. The Trekkies are probably saying it's a young version of Khan Noonien Singh. Was that his name?
Soon. Yes.
Okay.
And he looks absolutely not at all Indian.
Doesn't look like Ricardo Montalban, talk like Ricardo Montalban. And Little Tattoo is not in the movie either. Of course,
no.
He wasn't in the other movie.
Now, I loved Ricardo. I think Ricardo Montalban's Khan is the single greatest villain in all of movie history.
And he played such character in Fantasy Island. It was fun watching, because Fantasy Island was on at the same time Wrath of Khan. It was fun watching him stretch himself and become more
of a
villain.
Yeah, such a shocking contradiction in terms of characters.
Although in the past, Ricardo Montalban used to play villains on spy shows a lot, but we had kind of forgotten about that during the Fantasy Island days.
Right, and I wasn't a big fan of Fantasy Island, so I didn't have that baggage.
That was a horrible show.
Right. But he was absolutely brilliant in the original movie. So I actually was thinking there's no way they're going to do this, try to reprise this role. But what they did do is they did something, they played it completely differently because they've redone this timeline. It's not exactly the way it was before. So the story plays out completely differently. There's really not... There are references to previous movies and previous events and things, which I found
to
be very
fun. Without the story being reproduced.
Right, exactly. So it was a very exciting thing for me because as a Star Trek fan, I'm hearing these, hey, I recognize that. You know, I know what they're talking about here and there, even though they're brief passing references. But the way Khan plays out as a villain is much more complex than the original movie where... Originally, we have somebody that is absolutely hell-bent on revenge, and that's one of the wondrous things about his character. Here, we have somebody that we actually have a much greater level of sympathy for, and he even is saying that he's doing this because not only was he pushed past the edge, but he's doing it because he loves his crew, the people that he's supposed to be leading and taking care of. He considers them his family. And he's got to do these things to free them and save them, ultimately. And these are really sympathetic reasons to like a character. And so we're faced with the horror of terrorism blatantly in our face. We see some primary characters killed by Khan by his own hand directly. And then as the movie progresses, we're drawn into Khan as a human being, not just as a monster, but as a person.
With his own agenda. Now, Nick, last week at this time, you had not seen the movie. You have now. How did you like it?
I liked it a lot, actually. I really enjoyed it. One of the big complaints that I heard going into the movie that I can totally understand is it's not 100% faithful to the past Star Trek films and TV show. In that it's too much brawn, not enough brain, you know, that type of thing.
Right.
That's a
so you don't mean
the
timeline change. You mean the tone and the nature of the story.
The way the characters are portrayed in the characterization.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I felt that was its great weakness. For example, Dr. McCoy, he has some good lines, but then that's all he's got.
That's all he has.
Yeah. He's got his one-liners.
Although I have to say, Carl Urban
He's awesome.
Oh yeah. Man, he was so good as Bones. He was of all the characters. He was my favorite in the first one. He's my favorite in this one. Yeah. I think.
And it must be fun for him to play the part because he probably grew up watching Star Trek. Yeah. And he must be.
He must have studied.
So Nick, you heard that going in, but then did that personally? Was that your same opinion when you watched it, or is he saying you disagreed with what you heard?
I actually agreed with it.
Oh, you did. Okay.
But the one thing that is a little quizzical to me is that. I feel that the first one had that too. So I'm wondering why people were so, you know, why people picked on that with this one when the last movie had the same
problem.
That was
pretty established. See, that's why I said last week that I like this one better, because I think any problem I had with this new series I was going to have.
You were over it.
Yeah. And so for me, it could only get better, really.
Right. Right. You
know? And it got better.
It's the tone. That's the tone of the movie. This is
exactly.
What these movies are. That, so enjoy it for what it is.
Yeah.
Right. And last time I said I don't like the new Kirk, and I think this plays into it because he is just playing this over-the-top action character where previously there was a lot more compassion and thought put into the character.
So you wanted to see him say, "We've got to stop Khan."
Yes.
It sounded a little more like Shatner.
Absolutely. Yeah, okay. Of course. You can't get away without a line like
that. I have a question for both of you guys.
Okay.
Since we're going spoilerific.
Spoiler. spoiler on steroids this week.
Okay. Yeah. I'm gonna in the spirit of it. What was your opinion of basically Spock and Kirk switching spots in this movie? You know, where in Star Trek II, it was
Kirk
Spock,
makes the sacrifice.
Right.
That's why we both joked last week. Is the next one going to be called The Search for Kirk?
They even gave Spock the iconic Khan. They gave him that.
Well, and remember, they had Spock go to the original Spock from the original timeline and ask him what had previously happened. And so this Spock learned in the movie that it had been him.
Which I kind of agree with your complaint about the timeline. I thought that was cool. Just seeing Leonard Nimoy, I thought was cool.
Well, it's always good to see Leonard Nimoy. Yeah,
I was surprised that he actually was willing to do it again because they had dragged. I mean, he agreed, but he is very, I guess you could say, almost anti-Star Trek. He didn't appear in anything.
Well, you know, when the Next Generation first premiered, they tried to get him to be in the very first episode of the first season. He asked for $1 million. This is
wow.
This was back in the mid or late 80s when $1 million was. I mean, today we talk about trillions of dollars with the deficit. But and they asked DeForest Kelly then if he would be in it, and he did it for scale.
Wow!
But then now later on, they did have him in, but he cut a deal because the episode that he was in, the two-part episode where he was really in 1 minute of part one and then a lot more part two, but they called it two-part episode. He made a deal for them to be able to have a reference in the TV show to a plot that had happened in Star Trek VI, so they didn't have to pay him as much. They made a mutual deal, and Star Trek VI came out right around the same time as the two-part Leonard Nimoy. But it is interesting. He for somebody who's been so difficult before, he sure likes being in them now.
Yeah, well, what you point out there too is that's what gave us the whole plot, the whole foundation for the current movies was that he was in that, and he was with the Romulans in that two-part episode.
Right.
And that's the whole, I mean, we get everything in the new series from that because that's how the timeline got.
But Nick, you were asking us what we thought of them.
Because I mean, some people didn't like it.
Well, the only thing I didn't like is, like I said last week, I thought the reason they changed the timeline was so that they didn't have to keep going back to the story, and I wondered why they were still so focused on the timeline. It was fun. I found it fun to sit there and go, oh, this time Kirk's going to make this. But I was wondering, I always try to get into the writers and producers' heads and wonder why they did it, and I couldn't quite figure out, other than maybe just to make it fun.
I read an article, I don't know if I read it before or after, but anyway, to answer your question, Bob, they did change the timeline so that they would have the freedom to do anything they want.
Okay.
Now, the freedom to do anything they want means they can reprise previous things or just break new ground. So J.J. Abrams himself said, I tossed out this idea of doing Khan to the writers to see what they could come up with, just for the heck of it. And this is what they came up with. So it was actually just sort of a playful kind of thing, it sounded like. And I like that. I mean, that's... To me, that's exactly why you would break the timeline.
Right.
You would break it so that you have freedom, not so you don't want to be locked into one thing or the other. So they're not. They showed us in this film that they are not sticking to the previous timeline. Well, not at Everybody all. Acted they've completely even differently. And there's some kind of... George Lucas talks about Star Wars, the first series and the second series, quote unquote, rhyming, because you see sort of similar things occurring in the two series. And I think that in a way you could say the same thing about this, where it's sort of like a rhyme where Kirk's, you know, he dies in this one, or and Spock died in the other one. So you have that, you have that little bit of juxtaposition there, but it's not so much that they're, oh, we've got to do this. It's just, let's do it.
Yeah,
for
there's a little bit of Hebrew proverb rhyme, because in Hebrew proverbs, sometimes they'd write a line and then the next line would be the opposite. The first Star Trek, the motion picture, had about was about as anti-action as the first J.J. Abrams one was action.
Right.
So, boy, they did a real good rhyme with those two.
Yeah. Thank God for that.
But we also saw, we were talking about Khan, but we also saw they met a Tribble before they met Cyrano Jones. That was the other big significant thing.
Oh, there
the
was a reference to see, one of the things I freaked out about was they mentioned the ship that they've got on board. And this is from the Mudd incident. And that's a reference to Harry Mudd.
I did not catch that.
Almost like had a heart attack at that moment. I'm like, okay, hopefully they're gonna pull Harry Mudd in. Harry Mudd in the original series was a very funny character that I think they had in two episodes.
He was in two. And in the animated great. In the animated series, they brought him back again with the same voice, Roger C. Carmel.
Oh, great. Yeah, you know what? I saw the animated series as a kid and don't remember.
The animated series was pretty bad for the most part, but they did have Harry Mudd in one of them. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Well, hopefully we'll get to see somebody reprise that role, and hopefully it'll be somebody good, because that was a great character on Star Trek.
One of the other interesting things I thought they did with this movie in terms of older characters is her first name escapes me. Marcus.
Carol Marcus. Marcus. That's where Kirk's son comes from. She was a big character in The Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, she was. Yeah. It looks like she's going to be a crew member from this point.
Well,
right.
Maybe Kirk's son will live this time, because what I absolutely hated about The Search for Spock is I liked seeing Kirk's son introduced in The Wrath of Khan, because I thought, these guys aren't getting any younger. Introduce some new characters.
Right.
And I love Kirstie Alley's Vulcan character, so they replace her with another actress who was
not as good.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Not as good at all.
But even if she was good, she wasn't the same actress.
Kirstie Alley.
And then Kirk's son, who was the other good character, they kill him off, and then they destroy the ship. It was pretty...
I think they undid a lot of the good stuff.
Whale movie so much, because it followed Star Trek 3, and they lightened things up a little bit. Right. Star Trek 3 was just heavy and depressing.
I think that the son dying in Star Trek 3 really pushed over the edge. To me, that was really unnecessary. They should have killed the Vulcan chick at that point if they were going to kill someone.
Now, it did make you hate the Klingon villain more, were cheering when Kirk pushed him off the cliff. And that was Christopher Lloyd. He plays a mean villain when he has to.
What's great about that is to think about the way the Klingons are depicted in The Next Generation and primarily in Deep Space Nine, which is where I think that series really fleshes them out. A lot of that goes back to Christopher Lloyd's portrayal of how they act and look and some of the attitudes that he had and portrayed in that film. We hadn't seen the Klingons ever do before in the original series. And now this over-the-top depiction, and that's how the Klingons are from then on.
Speaking of the Klingons, that was another thing I did. Can't they ever make the freaking Klingons look like the same? I mean, it's enough. We already suspended belief in the original series where they looked like human beings, except their eyebrows were painted. Okay, we'll grant that. They didn't have good makeup in those days. But then, I mean, like you said, in Star Trek III, the Klingons looked a lot the way they continued to look in The Next Generation in Deep Space Nine. But you go to Star Trek VI, and they hardly look that way at all. You go to this Star Trek, and they've got a little bit of an indentation on their forehead, but it's almost like every time they make a movie, why do they always keep wanting to make the Klingons look different? Did their foreheads also have to change as part of the space-time continuum?
Well, you know what? I don't feel like there is a big change. Once they get to the Klingons look in The Next Generation or in Star Trek III and from then on, there's some variation, but it's not so radical that you'd say, oh, the Klingons are totally different. Now, in this show, though, in this movie, they do look different enough that there is a noticeable change stylistically. But you know what? I felt like that was also kind of something you could let go, because they did that between the original series and the movies. And we know the reason is because the makeup wasn't available and they wanted to make them look more threatening when they had the budget to do it in the movies. So here they do it again, but I think it was just once again the sort of they've got the freedom to do it, and then they've got this precedent previously where they look different. So
yeah,
they'll go ahead and make them look different, but they're not. I mean, they still look like Klingons. I would have even said if one of these guys showed up in the other, you know, if we were watching Deep Space Nine and this makeup was used, I would never have said, wow, he doesn't look like a Klingon
at all. I don't know.
If
they hadn't called them Klingons, it might have just looked like some alien to me.
I don't know. I don't agree with that, but, you know, they're also not really on screen for very long in a close-up shot because they're sort of this revealing of them, and then something happens, and then that's it. You just have action from then on, and they're fighting and everything, and so you don't really see the Klingons' faces
anymore.
Well,
Mark, you were making some comments about war and violence, and I want to make sure that your point of depth doesn't get too sidetracked by all this talk about Klingons and time continuums and Carol Marcus and all the other tribbles.
Yeah, so we start to geek out on Star Trek.
If you had more you wanted to say, I want to give you a chance to do that.
Well, like I said, there is a lot to this movie because I think they had a lot of opportunity because of the challenging concept, but terrorism and the way we've dealt with terrorism since 9/11 and how awful terrorism is. I mean, there's just no way to state it otherwise, that they had a lot of things they could do with how they're approaching the theme of this movie. And I think they did give us a lot of, they threw out a lot of questions. And as I was kind of driving towards with Khan, he is not a monster. He is a human being, and we're really thrown into the arena with him as a human. Okay, he's bad. You know, we don't know if we should trust him. There's a lot of conflict with this character, but what do we feel about him as the movie progresses? I think it for me, it changed a couple of times, and I thought that was really a good thing because we really don't view terrorists as human beings, and what drives them to do what they're doing, what drives a person to commit an absolute, undeniable act of evil, does that mean that their humanity is completely gone after that? I think that's a
good question.
Well,
you're raising
an
interesting question because, see, I wouldn't say that I don't view terrorists as human beings. And with Khan, at the terrorist in this movie, I'm tying in the other movies and the TV episodes since that's what they're trying to get us to do. It seems to me that what drove him in those other episodes was that he was genetically superior and he just thought superior people should rule, period.
At a certain point, that absolutely comes out in the film. However,
there was a loyalty to his friends in this
also.
Yeah,
like I said, he declares, he actually says, quote, I love my crew. They are my family. And I mean, how can you disconnect from that kind of emotion? That is a very powerful statement for him to be making. And the actor is so good in this film. He's not just throwing that out. I'm a terrorist and I'm going to tell you this just so you can be sympathetic. He really believes it in the film and he sells it. So what do we do with a character like this as we're watching a movie?
Well, I mean, at the risk of flipping over to Star Wars for a second, Anakin Skywalker's do become Darth Vader's. I would say that there are people that I would not say that when I see an evil act committed, that means I'm of the opinion that from day one, this person was born as a monster. I do think evil is a point that we reach. And I think sometimes Christians have difficulty distinguishing the fact that we're all sinful from the fact that some people become evil, because all of us are sinful, which means a part of our nature is evil. I believe it's when we stop struggling with the nature and completely give into it that we become evil. And I don't see a lot of difference between somebody who says, I'm going to conquer the world because I'm genetically superior, or somebody who says, I'm going to conquer the world because my religion tells me to conquer the world. Now, you know, people make all kinds of politically correct excuses for terrorists today, like, well, it's probably because of America's oil interests, blah, blah. And I don't think we have a lot to brag about with our oil interests in the Middle East. I'll give them that. But that if you listen to the terrorists themselves talk, they're pretty honest about the fact that they're doing this because we should be subjected to Islam. It doesn't mean all Muslims feel that way, but it does mean that the ones that are terrorists, they are claiming it's their religion. They are claiming they're superior. They are claiming we're inferior. That doesn't mean that I believe that every one of them is evil. But by the time someone's slitting a stewardess's throat, I think he's reached a point of evil.
He's crossing a line, yeah.
That doesn't mean that, you know, years ago, he might have had a more sincere motive for being caught up in that, absolutely.
Okay, now, the next question. See, I like this. Everything you said ties in so well with the way the movie flowed.
It was very much a parallel to that.
Yeah, and I think that, again, this is raising these questions and how we look at modern politics and the modern world. Not just politics, but, you know, terrorism is a reality of modern world outside of politics. The other question that I think it raises is there some kind of redemption for Khan at some point? I mean, to me, okay, you see him doing these acts that are absolutely despicable, yet he's completely desperate at the time he's doing them. It's made clear to you in the movie. Now, it's also made clear at a point that he does want to conquer the world, and that it is because he's genetically engineered, and that baggage, so to speak, from the other timeline, from the other series, we see that because was Khan's motivation.
And I do get that more from the other movies than I got it from this particular movie.
Yeah, so if we were going to, there is a point in the movie where, you know, you're really connected to Khan sympathetically, I think, I was anyway, when he's starting to help the crew and he's made a statement about why he's done what he did.
But then he does turn on them again at the end, too.
Yeah, so, I know, and because they've got to have a villain, I think. However, and that's Khan's character, too. I think it wouldn't have been accurate to Khan as a character
if he didn't. And a villain in a movie is more interesting when he's three-dimensional and it's not just pure good or pure evil.
But what I'm driving towards here is, at a certain point, we're asking ourselves, is Khan okay? Is he going to be a good guy, quote unquote, or to put it in more human or realistic terms,
can he be redeemed?
Exactly.
Well, Mark, you've seen Return of the Jedi. If Darth Vader can be redeemed, anybody can be.
Right.
Although, to answer from a Christian point of view, and since we're looking at the analogy to Christianity, I'm a big believer with the Bible and God that there's rules and exceptions to rules. Miracles, for example, are exceptions to the rules of nature.
Right.
The Bible teaches that everybody has a chance to repent and give their lives to Christ. The Bible also says that there's a point people reach. They call it the blasphemy of the Holy Spirit. They call it the hardness of heart, the searing of the conscience. There's a point people reach. Now, I don't know where that point is.
Right. We're not
so
God.
I can't look in and judge. But there is a point where a person's so much given into evil that God is done with them. As a general rule, I would say that by the time an Adolf Hitler does what he does, or Saddam Hussein does what he does, or some of these terrorists that just went and just murdered a guy with a machete. I would say the general rule says that person reached their point, they're in hell. Are there exceptions to the rules? Would I leave a window open that maybe even at that 11th hour as they're dying and there's time and eternity is crossing, that maybe there's still redemption? Yeah, because we got to be careful. We're just a bunch of dumb humans. What do we know? We got to be careful to let God be God and let God judge. But I would say, as a general rule, I don't have any problem saying probably those people are in hell. But is it possible that they still gave their lives to Christ? Well, not only is it possible, but I hope they did. That's what I would prefer to see as a Christian. On the other hand, if they didn't give their lives to Christ, I'm glad they're answering for what they did. I'm glad God doesn't just sit back and let it go.
Right, we want justice.
We want justice and we want mercy. God holds justice and mercy in tension, and the cross is an example of God's justice and mercy combined. Justice says our sin had to be paid for. Mercy said Jesus paid for it on our behalf.
Right, which is great. Awesome. Amazing. And we're getting this all from Star Trek, believe it or not.
The gospel according to Shatner.
Well, in this case, I guess it would be
Abrams. Yeah.
Yes. But so like I said, this movie has a lot to offer, even though it's considered a popcorn movie. And this really is an action movie. That's one of the things I think I've heard a little bit of complaints about it, and I felt it a little bit. This movie, once it starts rolling, man, that's a rock that doesn't stop until it hits bottom. I mean, the movie is just action after action after action, which is great.
To a degree, I have to say, and I said this a little bit last week, I could stand more dialogue in these movies. And to me, I enjoy the action more when it's not just nonstop. But having said that, it was certainly good action. It certainly was riveting. It was certainly well done.
I think for me, one of the reasons I really, really enjoyed the action so much in this film is the Enterprise was considered to be a quote-unquote character, and there was a lot of great effects and things we saw them doing with the Enterprise that we had never seen before. And so, since a lot of the action revolved around that aspect, I was pulled into that really deeply.
Speaking of the Enterprise, I have to say, we haven't talked about Scotty. I like Scotty.
Oh, yeah, he's a great character.
He looks like a young Scotty. He looks a lot like James Doohan. He talks like Scotty. I mean, I think Scotty's well done in this.
Yeah, I'm a fan of Simon Pegg anyway.
Simon Pegg,
yeah,
yes.
He's really
wonderful.
Good.
He's very good. Well, Mark, 2 weeks and we probably still didn't get through everything, but we will have you on again soon because there's a lot of new blockbusters, not the least of which is the new Superman and a lot of others. So we'll have you on again soon. And for those of you wondering why we didn't talk about politics for the last 2 weeks, well, we did get into it a little bit talking about the movies, but you can always go to my Washington Times Communities column and read my latest view on the news. We try to have more of a variety here on the radio, but I will be back with you next week. See you then.
Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.